La 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 la. Hello, hi, welcome to First Graft. I'm Heidi James, and this is a podcast where we talk about writing, creativity, and first drafts, the hard graft, the first draft. I have a treat for you. I was joined the other day by the very talented and very charming Renan Heshen, just after his launch, his UK launch. His book, Leonard and Hungry Paul, is really getting some traction. He has some very fancy famous fans and brilliant reviews. And yeah, you should read it. It's fantastic. One tiny little note, my voice in the following recording sounds pretty shaky and ropey and rough. So it's fair to say I had a tiny bit of a hangover. We had a lot of fun. So yeah, without further ado, let me introduce the pretty marvellous Renan Heshen. So, hello.
Oh, Heidi, thank you for having me here.
It's my absolute pleasure. I'm here with Renan Heshen.
Yes.
Did I get that right?
Renan Heshen, yeah.
Renan, okay. It's a beautiful name.
Thanks, yeah.
And, yeah, I'm really chuffed to discover that I've got some Irish. So I feel like we could be cousins.
Yes.
I've decided that I'm a cousin now of everyone who I really admire and respect. Like, we're family.
Yeah, great. Yeah. That's not a bad starting point. Yeah. Great, yeah.
Yeah. So we were at the launch, or the UK launch, to get it right, because you've already launched the book, Leonard and Hungry Paul,
yeah,
by Blue Moose, in Dublin, right?
Yep.
And so last night we were at the UK launch in the Book Corner, the Peace Hall, Halifax. How did you find it? Did you enjoy yourself?
I really loved it, yeah. It's the launch of a book is, as I'm finding out, a really kind of special occasion, you know, and it's not in the extravaganza type way. It's actually quite an intimate thing because you read the book and everyone just sits there quietly and listens to it. Some people have read it before, some people haven't.
Mm.
And then you get this interaction with people, which is so different. My background is in music, and so a launch of an album is very different. It's a performance, it's a very buzzy sort of type experience. Mm. But I felt the atmosphere in the room last night was kind of the atmosphere of the book, you know what I mean? It was kind of a gentle, quiet atmosphere, but not a sleepy one. You know, it felt like people were engaged, but in a kind of very calm way. It was nice.
It was lovely, wasn't it? And what I thought was really lovely about it was, obviously, you don't live around here. So often launches are full of friends and family, and you had your sort of extended book family, if you like. But there were loads of people there because they've read the book, they've heard about the book, that, you know, aren't intimately connected in any way, but they are connected to you through what you've written, which I think is so lovely. And everyone was really delighted to be there. It was a really lovely launch, I thought.
Yeah, thanks.
And people just want to pick up on something you said there, actually, about how the book is quiet. But what I think is so incredible is it's about, there are extraordinary dynamics in the book. They don't shout, but the dynamics of family is really beautifully written, very subtle, but it's there. And I wondered, is that something, have you always been very observant of those sorts of family relationships and dynamics? Are you from a large family? Because I think not everyone is given space to see that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm from a large family. In the book, they're small families, but I'm from a family of eight children. And my father died when I was seven, so my mother would work nights, and which meant that essentially I grew up in a house of children run by children.
Yeah.
So it was quite a raucous, chaotic.
Right.
But you know, we've it's a nice family, a happy family. It wasn't a difficult childhood by any means, but it was very different to what's in the book. But I think there are certain relationships and certain conversations that happen in the book that could only happen in family.
Yeah.
That, you know, if they were between a man and a woman in a romantic relationship, people would walk away. People would make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But in family, in theory, the rules of relationships should apply in family too.
Yes, I agree.
You should be able to break up with people when you no longer have things in common. You should be able to walk away and you should be able to move on. Not necessarily to a new family, but move on with your life.
I agree,
And I think a lot of the pain in families is people's either inability to do that or their sense that that's not possible. But also it means that in a family that is a happy family, and in the book they're essentially happy families, even though they're not without complication, it's the people's commitment to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to make it work.
Mm.
So the relationships are kind of controlled experiments.
Yeah.
And obviously what happens in family relationships is before you even think of them as relationships, you've already got 20 years history behind you.
Yes.
And the accumulated baggage and roles. And even though you change in life, like for example, my life has changed. In the past year, people see me as a writer. That's a completely new thing in my life.
Right.
Even people who've known me for a very, very long time would never have thought of me as a writer.
Right.
Right. So there's a change that I'm able to kind of in... I can show up in Halifax and everyone just accepts I'm a writer and we just get on with it.
Yeah.
In a family relationship, you can't reinvent yourself as easily.
No.
And so what you have in the book is people, it's where families going through a period of change. And I think often with novels and with writing, you're trying to decide what the Irish writer Clare Keegan calls an incision in time.
Mm-hmm.
You're deciding what point do you decide to look at these group of people at what point in their lives. What's the most interesting time to look at them?
Yeah.
And of course, it's a time when they're all going through change.
Yeah.
So what happens with in the book really is that people who essentially have a sort of solid foundation of a loving relationship go through, they all go through change at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a recalibration has to go on.
Yes.
And it takes them a while to figure out what that is.
Yes. Now that's that, I mean, that's so wise. I think you could almost this could turn into a family counselling. But it's true. Like often our friendships evolve and change with us, and they may not. We don't lose them necessarily, but they will just naturally drift and have a natural ending. Often when it, the time's right, they don't always have to have a big sort of toxic rupture or something. But in families. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know if you felt this, but I know lots of people, friends, have talked about this, where you can go home and suddenly you're 15 again, even though you're, you know, 38, with kids of your own. Suddenly you go home and your siblings are arguing like you were teenagers, and your mother has to come in and say, for God's sake, shut up. And you think, why are we doing this? Because you're sort of held almost in aspic, aren't you?
Yeah, that's a lovely way of putting it, yeah. And I think... in my own family, there's a big age spread.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at the younger end. So when I was doing my growing up, some of my older siblings had sort of left home at this age. And also, both my parents are dead. So that changes the dynamic then.
Of course, yeah.
You then, you don't have that. So sometimes people, as adults, see their other siblings at the family home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when that's gone, the relationship then changes. And you get into these bilateral relationships that up to previously were group relationships.
Yeah, because there's no nexus that holds you all in, that gathers you all together. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, for me, the book is about love in all its forms.
Mm.
Filial, so friendships, family relationships. Of course, there's a wedding, although that's not the central relationship. I mean, you know, it's about all these different ways of connecting, which I think is so lovely. So, I mean, tell us a bit more about... the book, just because obviously people won't have read it yet, about to read it, without giving too much away, how would you describe your beautiful book?
Essentially, my one word, when people say, what's your book about?
Mm.
People who discovered another book, I just say, it's a book about gentle people. And it's surprising that 90% of people are happy with that. The other 10%, it centres on a friendship between two men in their early 30s, Leonard and Hungry Paul, who are best friends. Leonard is a ghostwriter of children's encyclopedias.
Mm-hmm.
Hungry Paul is a judo white belt who works in a post office most Mondays.
Why is he hungry?
Well, here's the thing. He's called Hungry Paul in the book.
Yeah.
But only by the narrator. Nobody in the book calls him Hungry Paul. None of the characters call him Hungry Paul. It's a name. My wife's uncle has a friend, Two Pauls, Tall Paul and Hungry Paul. He's the only person who calls them those. And whenever I told people that, just as you did there, they laughed. So yeah. I always thought, if I ever do a book, Hungry Paul is going to be a name with some guy. And what I like about it is that it's a signifier that he's different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and also it's not a way you would normally describe people.
No,
you might say what's Heidi like, and you say, well, she has dark hair. What's Ronan like? Well, he's got a husky voice. You never say, what's he like? He's very hungry.
No,
so it sounds like a descriptor, but it's not.
Yeah.
So it kind of gives you a sort of sense, and I know people sort of have, some people have read the book and say, oh, is there a clue as to why he's called mm-hmm. that? And it's almost an exception to the otherwise consistent rule in the book, mm-hmm. which is that not to use labels.
Right.
So there's no surnames, there's no place names.
Yes.
There's very few physical descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a conscious avoiding of labelling mm-hmm. Of characters or you know, conceptualising more than necessary, really as a way of just clearing out some of the narrative space to focus on the human side of the people.
That's their
traits.
And it leaves, I think it was Mallarmé who talks about, more particularly about the act of naming and how to not name is to leave something free. I mean, I'm grossly paraphrasing. But, and I think that's really interesting. I think that, for me, that seems a very contemporary way of writing, because the minute we start to label, we do pin people and places and things down, and you're leaving without. It is very descriptive, the book. But it doesn't. It leaves space for the reader, and it leaves space for humans to be humans. It's really interesting you say that, because I'd noticed that. And I think it's really important now, because we're living in a time, well, have been living in a time for, you know, where this endless radical naming, radical labelling, radical partitioning that's so damaging and dangerous. So I think there's something really actually quite profound about not labelling.
Yeah, I think you're right that there is a huge tendency towards that these days, and what that essentially is a projection. Mm-hmm. You know, you're continually projecting. It's almost like a GPS system where you feel you give a label to yourself, so you have a fixed point, and then you project a label onto the other person, mm-hmm. like a GPS system. You can constantly check how close or distant they are from you.
Yeah, you're triangulating those.
And it avoids you actually just dealing with the person directly. It's a highly intermediated way of engaging with the world. Whereas I wanted the book to feel like a closed world where people were connecting directly. And I also conscious how the reader would read it. So, say, for example, I said I introduced a character called Heidi James, and Heidi James is a socialist. Say mm-hmm. if I said that. Mm-hmm. Immediately people would fill in a whole backstory for a person, a whole sense of who they are.
Yeah.
And also, if they are a socialist, they will say, oh, I'll see myself in Heidi. And if they're definitely not a socialist, they say, well, that'll tell me what socialists are like, but I won't find myself in that person.
Mm-hmm.
So they immediately, whether they decide to or not, they will immediately reconcile that person's profile to their own, and they make it about themselves.
Yeah.
And if you take away the labelling, at the end of the book, you know, people have a chance to find themselves in the characters without taking that shortcut of deciding whether they belong in the same group.
Yeah.
And not that these things were, you know, overt designs in the book, but as you go through at various sort of checkpoints in the book, mm-hmm. every 10,000 words or so, you get a sense of where it's going, what it's about. And if you have some of that stuff in it, you take it out and the book feels better. And at the end of it, you sort of have the whole thing together, you say, yeah, I can see why that was important now. Yeah. Sometimes you only really understand the book at the end or afterwards when people start reflecting back to you what they felt about it.
Yeah, that's very true. So you just sort of preempted my next question, really, which was lovely. So thank you. This is going very well.
You can leave now, Heidi. I'll just talk to myself.
Fine. Shall I? I've got a book I could read. You know, it's fine. So the process of writing, because obviously this is on First Graph, we talk about, you know, getting that first graph down and how sometimes it can flow and you get stuck. And Was there lots of planning? Were you sort of conscious, or was it, as you say, going back and thinking, like, remove that, and it hanging together the more and more you wrote? How did it come about?
My process is basically, my background is in music, so I was writing songs for a long time. And my the core of my practice, if you like, is to just trust the sort of creative instinct.
Yes.
So not to try and steer it, not to try and initiate it, but just to feel it and to feel a readiness. You just sort of have the sense that you get flashes of an idea keep coming to you.
Yeah.
Flashes of a character. Or I'll be, you know, in this room and I'll see a detail and it'll just, my mind or that character as they're forming in my mind will grab it and say, you know, Leonard always likes to wear purple jumpers or whatever the thing is. And I would just have a sense that it's ready. You know, creativity is sort of a build-up of energy in the same way that, you know, people who do running and so on, they say, oh, I have to get out for a run. It's that type of, you just know you have to go. So the last album I'd done was in 2012, so it'd been a 5-year gap, and I felt there was a real build-up, and I could see evidence of it all the time, the way I was expressing myself, the way my mind was gathering different ideas and organising them. So when I sat down, the only organising I did really was to take out a sort of, you know, an Outlook sort of calendar and to plot the chapters against time. Because I think one of the things you have to do with a novel is you have to, your handling of the passage of time is very important.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know you did that brilliantly in sort of those where you're kind of, you're going backwards and forwards and they kind of, you know, the way that sort of, it's almost like a Steve Reich music, you know, everything starts off together to get out of sync and then they kind of resynchronize.
It's
kind of
that,
the phasing is really difficult to do. But this is kind of linear in a sense. So I plotted against time and then I just sat down. Initially I decided I was going to write, I had a sense of Leonard as a character, and I was going to write something about him every day until I got to know him better. And then after the second day I said, like, sod it, I'm just going to do a novel, I'm just going to write it.
Yeah.
And I got to 10,000 words quite quickly, and then I sort of realised how the chapters would happen, you know, that it's, because it's done by switching between characters, it means you don't have to give the central character an implausible number of interesting things to do. So they can have downtime when someone else takes over the relay.
Yeah.
And they swap it. So it means you can keep the story chugging along without having to contrive big events.
Yep.
So that was one thing I used. I was conscious that the, one thing I figured out pretty quickly was that if you watch TV and you see two characters, you can always tell which is which because one of them is tall with a beard, one of them is small and bald. One's a man, one's a woman. So every time they come on screen, you never confuse who they are.
Yeah.
But in writing, that can happen. So I had to try and distinguish, and I distinguished them basically on two main things. One is the level of interiority.
Yep.
So Hungry Paul has no interiority at all, really. And others have, you know, like Grace has quite a lot.
Yeah.
Also, there's a backstory. Like Grace has quite a lot of backstory. You more or less get her full life story. Leonard, you get a little insight into his childhood years, and then we resume. Hungry Paul, we don't find out much about him at all, other than reflected through other people's conversations about him. So in that way, I sort of hoped they would feel different. And then I just wrote it. I always knew 4 or 5 chapters ahead what I was going to be doing. And I'd sit down, put my kids to bed, and I'd come down about 10, half 10, and I'd write for 2 hours. And I did that 6 nights a week for 3 months. I wrote the first draft. Then I took a month off, and then I went back, say, 2 or 3 months at a time, month off. And I did a series of edits. Of, you know, I would have done 1 or 2 full read-throughs. Then I would have done, read it out aloud.
Yeah.
Then I went through all Hungry Paul's bits. Then I went through separately all Leonard's bits, all Grace's bits. Each character went through all their bits, went through all the dialogue. Then I went through the chapters in reverse order so that I wasn't reading the story, just to see for the writing.
Yep.
And everyone...
That's a good idea, to go through it reverse order. That's a great idea.
It stops you reading the story, so then you're just reading a chapter at a time. It stops you following it through.
Yeah.
Because your mind, because when you're reading the story, you're just looking at it differently. And then I would have, intermittently, or when I felt my energy was flagging, I would have marked different sections that where I felt there were sort of poetic openings, or where I felt that there was room for a nice line, or there's some reflective pieces where you might have them, there's particular themes about the universe, particular themes around silence, particular themes around engaging in the outside world. So I would have felt they were sort of little meditative pieces or little mini, I wouldn't say essays, but little, you know, where I would have extended the sort of narrative digression a little bit. So those took a lot of work. I would have done a lot of edits of those, gone back to make sure that they didn't seem contrived or... see, one of the things I think about writing in third person, which I really like, is that your characters don't have to make speeches, you know. Because you can convey a lot in the narrative. So it was really, so I would have gone through a lot of edits that way over a long period of time, and got to a point where I felt it was ready. I think a bit like songwriting, you know you're finished when you keep going back and undoing your last batch of changes, you know. You kind of overshoot the mark and then you rein it in. So I knew after sort of Christmas of sort of 2017, that it was, which was about 9 months after I started, that it was done, and then I just, you know, got it ready for the submission process and everything involved there.
Do you take lots of notes?
No, none at all.
Oh. It's interesting what you're saying about how it sort of, there's something almost mystical, which is, this is a ridiculously metaphysical thing to say, because of course it's all about all our layers of consciousness, but I've been taking lots of notes and thinking, I must put this in the novel I'm writing at the moment, and then I go to the novel and I've already put it in.
Right.
It's really interesting how my thought process is they're already three steps ahead of me. I've already done it, but I'm thinking, well, I must make sure I'm thinking about that in that section. Then I go back and there it is. It's like, oh, okay. And for me, that is how I know it's working, in a similar way to you. When you start to, you're already five chapters, that, like, you know it's working because it begins to, you're not working. That's how you know it's working.
I've heard you talk about your the sound mirror and how you've got, you know, these sort of quite fragmented pieces. You're happy to write in bursts and in sections, and then at the end, it's a bit like what Olga Tokarczuk, the Polish writer, she described Flights as a constellation novel, and that she said, you know, stars are each individual entities, but we arrange them into constellations to make them into a narrative. So it's a really interesting, I think, kind of very exploratory, innovative way, I think, of working, you know, to kind of let your mind separately conjure up different things and then just sort of trust that somewhere at the back of your mind it knows what it's doing, you know, and that you will find it, you'll be able to discern a pattern at the end, you know. It's a very trusting way of writing, which I think is kind of daring as well. That's great.
Is it that thing about I love that about constellations, that they only make that pattern from here, from where we're looking, whereas if you go into outer space, they don't cohere in those patterns. I find that so, whereas a nebula or nebulae do, they do hold that shape. I think that's the difference.
Okay.
But that's sort of about how we make meaning. Constellation is a perfect metaphor for how we make meaning of what we see, of patterns and fractals, I think. But you talk about music, and there's something I thought was really, it came up last night at the launch and questions, and it's something I noticed. You use silence beautifully, which of course is a huge part of music. And Kierkegaard talks about how, you know, what's silent, what's invisible is what makes meaning. The gaps between words create the words, and all, you know.
Yeah.
So did you find those sorts of practices as a musician, were you conscious of them infiltrating your writing practice, or not really? Was it just, they're just, it's just your creativity, there isn't a discernible difference for you?
I think your creativity, I tend to think of it as kind of a lake. And there are different beaches into it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, music is one beach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, prose is another. Mm-hmm. But you're swimming around in the same imagination, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think creativity, we often talk about the creative process, which is the process of giving form to what's in the lake. But there's also a creative space, you know, as opposed to the actual process.
Mm-hmm.
And being in the creative space, just swimming around in it, even if you're not writing anything or doing anything, is very, very important. And you can, it's an openness to that. It's a natural curiosity, and always seeing the creativity that's around you all the time. And just even being in the presence of creative people, you know, even going to galleries, even just being exposed, you're swimming around in the right places where you're getting wet with creativity, shall we say.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's familiar. there are some, then when it comes to the sort of process and the level of technique, there are some very helpful things in, I think it'd be much easier to go from a musician to being a novelist than for going from a novelist to being a musician.
Yeah, yeah.
I think certainly trying to find those killer lines, you know, that which is a very, you know, songwriting are all about that. I also think that in songwriting you have melody, which is really, I always used to say melody was the mother of the song. Like the melody really holds the code mm-hmm. for the song in terms of what the lyrics will do, what the arrangement will be. You don't have that as obviously in prose, but then there is that rhythm, which is effectively a type of melody. So, you know, when you read some writers,
mm-hmm.
Like I read a lot of Japanese writers, and often you come away from the books not remembering that much about them, but you've kind of been hypnotized when you've been
mm-hmm.
reading them,
mm-hmm.
and they have that way of getting you in. So that's a sort of a musical side of things. And also just because you're in the practice of thinking about creativity and your relationship with it, I think being a musician puts you in that, because you have to, as a musician, you have to explain it to other musicians.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to work with other people. So it gives you that sense. I think the experience as a musician helped me work to my editor, because I wasn't saying, well, it's your idea or my idea. It was just,
yeah.
There were just billiard balls going around on the table, bouncing off each other. There wasn't a possessiveness on either side. So yeah. that kind of collaboration, I was very comfortable with that. And I really enjoyed it, actually.
Yeah, me too. When I was a kid, I trained to be a dancer when I was a child, and then was on stage a lot and acting and what have you. And I think I love collaborating with my editor, and I think it is because I'm used to that creativity being a collaborative space of listening to other people, not being afraid to try stuff,
yeah.
and understanding that that's all right. If it didn't work, it was interesting anyway. And I think that's really helpful, because I hear other writers who can't bear the editing, you know, they yeah. hate it and feel like it's their baby that's being, you know, dismembered almost. So I think it's quite useful for us. That's really interesting to hear you sort of talk about how, as a musician, you've got to let other people in and say, right, could you play the bass for me? And
yeah, and not to make it a personal thing. So say, for example, I got my way in the last 10 discussions.
Yeah.
If you haven't had the benefit of, you know, working in theatre or music, you might feel, God, I've got my way in the last 10 things. I'll just give away on this.
Mm.
But actually, they're all isolated decisions.
Yeah.
And it may be that you're right 99 times out of 100. It may be that the editor has the balance of it.
Yeah.
But I think the main thing is that it never becomes about whose turn is it to be right.
Absolutely.
You're just really exclusively focused on what's the right thing, what's the right decision.
Yeah. I'm not sure. We're in my funny little hotel room, but it's gone, whatever it was. Yeah, and it is about the work, actually. And I think that's what, when you're used to working collaboratively, it's not about, yeah, who's right, which decision. It's about, is this getting better? And even having the discussion, it can either firm something up in your mind. You think, no, this is the way I want this to go, but I'm yeah. glad you asked me, because
yeah.
it's made it more clear. Or, yeah, you're right, it isn't working, but I've been trying to shoehorn it in. And
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And you can, and at some level you know those. You know the ones that you think, oh, that was a really lovely line. And you know at some level in your bones it doesn't fit.
Yeah, totally.
And when you're called out on it, you can kind of feel the sort of, you know, tension of saying, oh, no. There's one line that we had in Leonard and Hungry Paul. And it was maybe, it had survived every edit.
Yeah.
For like 20, 30 edits, whatever. Yeah. And editor Lynn Webb just came in and said, this doesn't really work, does it? And I said, God, it's terrible. You know, that we're all more or less wrapping up and saying, that's mm-hmm. great. You know, and the line is sitting there kind of going, God, I can't believe I survived in the book this long. And you say, actually, before we leave, you're out. And it'll have to go, and it was the right thing to do. But sometimes it takes you a long time to see that. And I think what a great editor has the capacity for is that continual ability to sort of sorbet their reading of mm-hmm. the text and approach it fresh, so they see the things differently. And it's a great way to be, whereas, you know, once I've mentally accepted something, I find it very hard to, without prompting, find it very hard to reevaluate it later on.
Yeah, me too. But I think partly that's because it's the world we've created, so it's the world we can... It's out the world we're imagining, so we see it in all its complexity, whereas someone comes in fresh, they don't see what we're seeing, and so they will see the gaps that we can't see, I think. But I'm the same with you. I when someone says, oh, you know, this, I'm like, yeah, I kind of knew. Yeah. I knew. Could I get away with it? And then that's why I think it's really helpful, because there are other things I think, no, that's got to stay. I know why that is there. But I'm happy to build something around it so that it fits.
Yeah.
But then there are other things I'm like, okay, yeah, sure. I knew that one.
Well, that's it, yeah, because only the writer, and I do believe in the primacy of the writer, not in an egotistical way, but only the writer is receiving that creative charge. They're the only person who's connected to that.
Yeah.
So ultimately, that charge, you know when you're outside that charge and you're inside it.
That's a lovely way of describing it, the creative charge. That's beautiful. Yeah. I love that.
And I think when you will bolt things on and you will, you know, add things in, but you'll know what's fundamental to that. And exactly as you put it there, you may accept that you need to, because they don't have the benefit of that charge, they won't understand why it has to be there, where it's come from, or they won't realise that there was a process that led to this particular choice.
Mm.
And maybe you need to help them with that. You may say, well, he says this because this is what's going on in his head, and the editor might say, okay, now I understand it, but the reader doesn't have the benefit of that explanation, so you need to make sure that's somewhere in the text to help prepare the reader for this choice the character makes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is where it becomes really useful, I think. So what's next? What are you writing now? I know you've got another couple of books, right, signed with...
Yeah, I'm going to do... we signed for two more books of Blue Moose, and hopefully we do many more. The next one is a book called Panenka, which I won't say too much about. My sort of non-description of what it is that it's a redemption story about headaches.
Lovely, I'll take that.
And then the other... so I've written that, and I've done a couple of sort of full edits of that, and I'm at a stage where... There, I have two main beta readers, my wife and my friend Mike Stevens. So Mike has read it and my wife's reading it at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite different to Leonard and Hungry Paul, quite a different feel to it, and quite a different tone to it. And but I'm really, really happy with it. There's a lot of dialogue in it. Mm-hmm. So it's slightly shorter in word count, but a lot longer in pages. So I really enjoyed writing that. And I felt actually after Leonard and Paul, I still had a lot in the tank. It wasn't like an idea I had in reserve.
Right. You know,
it wasn't that these two other ideas were sort of my plan B and plan C.
Mm-hmm.
They came after Leonard and Paul, and the Panenka came out quite quickly again. I think partly because I had the sort of 5-year hiatus since the last album to write in the first book. And then Ghost Mountain, I haven't come up with a good nutshell for that, but it's, again, that's quite different. Again, all the three books are very different.
Brilliant, yeah.
And I think my long-term plan is just to keep writing, to write books I haven't read before, and to just keep writing, including books I haven't written before.
Yeah.
So to keep writing different things. And I think part of... I was always like that when I was writing songs anyway. And I think part of that, one of the best pieces of advice I think I ever got was when I first started working in tax,
mm-hmm.
my boss said to me, in this job, you have to get used to disappointing people.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, people come in looking for various different changes in the budget, and you listen to them, you talk to them, and at the end you say, that's not going to happen, and in fact, it's probably never going to happen.
Mm.
And even though he meant that in the context of that job, I think it's very good advice for life, to get used to disappointing people.
Yeah.
and I think it's to get comfortable with the discomfort of that. Naturally, as humans, we want to make other people happy.
Mm-hmm.
And without becoming a psychotic personality, to resist the sort of the really seductive human instinct to please other people. And I think as an artist, as a writer, you have to get ready to disappoint people.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think it's a disappointing book in terms of standard of that, but it's not about you know, saying, well, Leonard and Hungry Paul has created a certain perception in people of me that I now have to repeat. And there is a strong feeling in me to try and say, you know, when people are saying, oh, I love the warmth of Leonard Henry Paul, or it's so touching, mm-hmm. trying to say, you know, you can sort of feel, oh, the next one's not going to be like that.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
The artistic part of me, which, you know, realises to be self-sustaining over a long period, says, you're going to have to get to know me over a few books.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I hope that in time, if I do them well, that what people will think is, I don't know what the next book will be like, but I know it'll be worth investigating. And that's really what I want to do.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I absolutely love that. And it's true, if you're trying to please people, it's pathological for a start. You know, it's unhealthy, and no one, you can't. It's impossible. So you end up with a ragtag mishmash of nothingness where you've been trying to please.
We're both on the same publisher, and Blue Moose are really about putting the writer first, and there's, you know,
yeah, they're very lucky. They don't say, right, can you repeat that? That was a success. Can we have some more? It's like, no. Whereas a lot of publishers do that.
Oh yeah, and I'd say if you do two books that are similar, that's it for life. I think it's very difficult if you decide to try and repeat it to keep everyone happy. At that stage, it's much, much harder to move on.
Yeah.
Whereas if in your second book, or, you know, I think you're on, is your fourth book, is it now?
Yeah, it's my third book, Blue Moose, but yeah. And they're all, as you say, completely different. Yeah. Although there is there's a thread of something, but that's because I'm the one who wrote them. There's something that will always, they have is something in common. Or that, you know, there's a sibling resemblance.
Yeah.
If you like.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're very different.
And I think that sort of, you know, artistic thread is the reassurance to the reader who says, oh, you're going to be jumping around. So in other words, your natural artistic personality will come out over time. And that's a healthy similarity.
Yeah.
Not in the sort of, this is what people liked, I'll try and repeat that.
Yeah.
I'll try and do a series of those, or I'll try and do another similar one. Because people will read two of them, and after that they'll sort of write you off and say, I've already read that book.
Yeah. People like it, though, don't they? They reread the same, you know, they read the same author for the same formulaic.
Yeah, especially series. The series have become very, very popular.
Yeah.
In certain genres. And I can see the market for it. Like, I think, say, in crime, for example,
mm-hmm.
where they like a particular, detective or something like that. And I could see how that connects up. But, that doesn't appeal to me. I feel that there was a certain discipline in trying to say everything interesting I could think of about Leonard Henry Paul in one book,
mm-hmm.
and not keeping anything back.
Yeah.
And not saying, well, you know, a few years down the road, you know, the characters are married, they have kids, and, you know, what would that be like? Like, no, you're all right. I'll leave it there, and you can.
Yeah, absolutely. A few people said to me, "Oh, I'd love to know what happens to Melanie from Say the Doves next." Or will you? I loved her. Will you write about her again? No.
Yeah, she should be great, actually. Yeah.
But the reason people like her is because you don't know very much, and what you do know is her mystique will go. Do you?
Yeah.
And in a way, it's a bit like, I don't know. When I was an actor, lots of people coveted a role on a big soap opera or what have you. But for me, that was, I might as well go work in an office.
Yeah.
To do the same character day in, day out. It'd be the same, writing the same world. I like to put that world away and find.
The same. Some people, like, you know, look at David Jason, for example, one of the few examples probably of somebody who's repeatedly.
Oh yeah, but he's like an exception. He's brilliant.
There's
very
few people that can do it. He's repeatedly come up with, you know, he's dipped into characters, whether it's, you know, Granville or Del Boy or, you know, whatever the guy from.
I'm laughing just thinking about that, man.
Very few people can pull that off, and but I think when it comes to being a writer, I suppose writing a book is such an investment of time, and not just before you write, but afterwards. It's an investment of energy to promote it and talk about it and to just live in that world. If you're not crazy about it, there'd be a very, I think it'd be a really, you know, difficult couple of years to be doing a book that was for other people but not for you. I think that'd be very uncomfortable. I can't imagine doing an interview like this about a book that I didn't really feel strongly about.
No, you're absolutely right. So tell me what you're reading at the moment. I know you read lots. I mean, you're a voracious reader. What are you reading at the moment that you've loved?
I've read a few really interesting books lately. The one I'm reading at the moment, I've just started, is by a Chinese writer called Yan Lianka.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Lenin's Kisses. And I came across him last year, and I read two of his books last year, which were both really good. Probably my favourite book last year was The Day the Sun Died, which is a book he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And they are almost sort of parable-like. He's a Chinese writer, so really he's writing about living under the Chinese regime and mm-hmm. what that's done, in particular to rural communities, and how really the powerhouse behind the Chinese economic story are the ordinary working people, which is yeah. a very different narrative to what the political system would portray.
Mm-hmm.
But because he can't do it overtly, because he would be in physical danger if he did that, he kind of writes to me as these sort of almost parables. So he's really good. I read a really good book called Shtetl Love Song, which is by a Lithuanian writer called Grigory Kanovich.
Mm-hmm.
He's a similar vintage to Jan Lianka, another guy. He's his 90s actually now. And really he's writing the story about these shtetls, which are essentially Jewish villages in yeah. Lithuania, which are gone now. It's a sort of a conservation project as much as anything else, to record the characters, his own family,
mm-hmm.
And in the interval, you know, before the Second World War, where Lithuania became almost a form of doormat for first of all the Russian
yeah.
Army going through, and then the German army. So it was, they were both very good books. I also really enjoyed Tokyo UNO Station, which is a new book by a Japanese writer called Yu Marie,
mm-hmm.
and it's about one of those popular train stations in central Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
and there's a big park there where a lot of homeless people live.
Right.
And what the book is really interesting about is you sort of see homeless people, and everyone all over the world sees homeless people and feels huge sympathy for them. But I think it really gets home the idea that people become homeless. You know, mm-hmm. there's a descent there.
Yeah.
And people come from a place that's actually quite familiar to non-homeless people. You know, they had a life, they had relationships and responsibilities, and they become homeless. But she doesn't overdo the sort of potentially sentimental side of that, of isn't it terrible that it happened to a person. It's really just showing how sort of arduous, really, that yeah. life is, and how vulnerable it is. So lots of different things. Sometimes people ask me, how do I have time to read so much? What I do is I read lots of short, like I read on the train, my lunch break, mm-hmm. bit of bedtime, and it just all adds up, really.
Yeah.
I think since I started, I think from the day I more or less got a contract from Blue Moose, I sort of treated writing as a second job, and so I treat reading as part of that job. I sort of commit to it as if I'm not writing, I put the writing time into reading, and that's what I try and do. What's your sort of...
Similar, I mean, I've always been, just had my head in a book
since
childhood. Yeah, I'm obsessed with books, and luckily as an academic, it is my job. You know, so I am legitimately working all the time. Yeah. I'm reading, but as you say, I read for not just to teach, to talk about books, but also to learn how they're constructed. I've taught creative writing as well as English literature, and I've had, and I kid you not, I've had students say, "I don't like reading." Do I have to read all these books? Like, but you want to write and you don't want to read. Like, yeah. It's like saying, I don't like humans, but I want to be a doctor. I couldn't care. Do you know what I mean? It's like, how can you possibly? I just think, yeah, and for me, it's that lovely, empathic, beautiful understanding the world through so many different. I couldn't imagine not being able to read. That would break my heart.
Yeah, did you ever see the comedy series Garth Marenghi's Dark Place?
No.
Yeah, it's very, very funny. It's kind of similar humour to The Office, but it came a long time before that. But the guy is a science fiction writer, and he has that sort of, you know, head to camera where he's really, really serious. But he says, you know, I'm probably one of the only writers who's written more books than he's read.
Oh my God. Ooh. I don't trust you.
So, yeah, it's strange. I've never done any sort of creative writing training, but I've heard people say that about it.
But you've read, so that is the training, really.
Yeah, yeah. But it's funny, it makes me wonder what people's motivation is to be writers. You know, exactly as you say, why, because actually you have to read, like, reading is just such a good training. Like, in particular, I read a lot of international fiction, and it's not to be willfully obscure. But what I've really learned from that is a lot of the conventions around creative writing are probably more English language conventions.
Yeah.
So if you look at the structure of...
They're very American, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So if you look at the structures, for example, around... If you look, I mentioned Olga Tokarczuk. You look at Dasha Dernditch, I think how you pronounce it, who's a Croatian writer. She's been on a few lists lately for her book, Doppelganger. You know, just structurally, it wouldn't conform to any... In fact, some judges and prizes would question whether it's even a novel.
Right.
You look in the sort of Japanese or Korean novels that have come out in the last few years, nothing really happens in them. You know, they're really just, you know, probably Leonard and Hungry Paul would probably fit more closely with that sort of aesthetic than an American aesthetic. But they're just about putting you into a place which is unquestionably a creative place. You know, it's got this kind of hypnotic, almost meditative sort of type of... sort of frequency range that you're in when you're in them, and then when you come out of it, you're not necessarily remembering individual events. It's just, you know, when I think about those books, I can kind of feel it. I can kind of feel those books again.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, really special that I can do that. So I think reading is important to educate yourself at what's possible. I would love to do. I was saying last time something. I would love to do a book that has just got cliches in it. I would love to do a book where it didn't drop the ball for a single sentence. That everything. And so you could say to someone, "This book, it might be the worst book you've ever read, but make sure that nothing in your book is in this book."
That's brilliant.
So I'd love to do maybe you know, when I finish this, I'll do that.
Yeah. The book of cliches. But you're right, because obviously all languages work differently, and we have this assumption that languages are the same, so that you can translate. Translation is very simple, and it's not. You know, languages, other languages have more words to say certain things. So, you know, with the plasticity of the human mind and consciousness, then that their world becomes what they are describing and discussing, and you know, and how verb structures and sentence structures and all that changes. So that our sort of, even the way English works in terms of its the sentence structures, in a way, is that realist phallic movement, you know, the build to a crescendo, the point. Where is the subject? Where is the object?
Yeah.
You know, we don't put the verb at the end.
Yeah, and it's interesting, there's some Irish writers... Some of the like really famous Irish writers have, because Hiberno English, like in other words, Irish people, the way Irish people speak and write English is a little bit different.
Yeah, which makes it, that's what I love. I love Irish literature for that very reason. It sort of unsettles without trying. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's like the Beckett who wrote in French to get around that.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote in French and then translated back to English. So you have writers of certainly the first half of the 20th century hyper aware of exactly the point you know that you're making, which is about how the sort of the format of the language really sort of, if you're not careful, can master the thought, you know, and kind of master the emotional range and master the actual you know imaginative force that's behind it. And
no, we were colonized.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a colony.
Yeah.
It's a colonization of thought, of ideas, of language. You know, it's the most violent. It's not the most violent, of course, physical, but it's incredibly violent because it robs cultures. It destroys cultures.
A friend of mine, I must ask him. He teaches translation, and he the Japanese. He speaks Japanese, and I've sometimes read about Japanese writers that they're great stylists.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I'd be interested to know is, because it uses the sort of pictorial symbols instead of words, whether style in Japanese means the same thing as it means in English, in the sense that you know, English style means it's a beautiful flowing sentence, but there's a visual dimension to their choice of how the images
that
look
that we can't possibly
that we can't replicate. There's in other words, it may be, is the word or the sentence a beautiful image?
Yeah.
Or is the relationship between the images beautiful in a way that we would never say, oh, I love the way the H in that, sorry, the H in that word is exactly the same as the H in this other word.
Yeah.
We'd say it's just typeface, nothing.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, your choice of which, I don't know, pictograms or whatever the phrase is.
A kanji.
Yeah.
But it is a picture, but they're kanji, yeah, but they are pictograms.
Okay, so like you might say, actually, this one looks better than that one.
Mm.
This is a good choice, not because of its felicity. Is that the word? Like, in other words, its appropriateness. It's actually because it looks better visually.
There's a brilliant essay I have to get to you by Abram. I can't, and it's about how the our alphabet has become so abstracted from the natural world, and it has helped foster and create this sense of us not being part of nature and part of the world, and that, you know, the initial signs that we're first reading and thinking about were footprints, were clouds, were the leaves, were, you know, that the world was talking to us, and that the cultures that still maintain a language or a written language, the alphabet, that echoes and resonates with the natural world around us still has a closer relationship to nature. And I'm sort of generalizing, and I'm reducing, actually, it's a beautiful essay, but it really, I find it so interesting. I think it's true. And I didn't even, for example, I didn't know that Aleph, A, was for ox. Aleph, and if you turn a capital A upside down, it's an ox with two horns. Q was for, I forget the word, for monkey with a tail.
Okay.
I mean, it's extraordinary, but we've abstracted it so much that it's part of this kind of very Western world, and Christianity is part of this, you know. We are, it's our dominion, we're in charge. Yeah. And I think there's something about the way we write that does that. I am pulling the world in, I'm doing this realistic thing, you know, that sort of 20th century realism that I think other works from other cultures, from other, in other languages, I think, and even now, I think in English people are trying to do, which is trying to create a work that actually is more closely aligned to another reality, something underneath language that's in the gaps, that's closer to the material in a way. Do you know what I mean? There's a sort of, rather than form imposing itself.
Yeah.
I'll have to get you that essay.
Yeah, do.
I think you'll love it.
That's really interesting about the alphabet. Like in Irish, there's no letter Q.
Is there not?
Yeah, there's no letter X. Even letter V was only, you know, it's still contentious. Some say it's related to the fact that the first president we had after independence was De Valera, and he wanted the V from his name, except in the Irish language and the spelling, we would have BH instead of a V.
My friend Maeve, of course, his name is spelled with BH.
So,
yeah.
So the sound is there, but it's expressed differently. So even, you know, two islands very close to each other, and even where there's English prevalent, it hasn't always fed through. Yeah, I think that whole area, I think, certainly when you come to translation, people, as I understand it, translators translate usually into their mother tongue.
Mm.
So they are able to adapt to the conventions of the language they're translating into.
Yeah, without losing something, if they're any
good. Yeah, but what it is, like, in the international booker, the prize money is split between the translator and the writer.
Mm.
You know, so that gives you a sort of sense of that it's a creative process of translation. And there are people, you know, some of the best people to follow on Twitter are translators, because they have very interesting things to say about books.
Mm.
You know, if you look at Jennifer Croft, who translated Flights, if you look at Morgan Giles, who translated Tokyo Union Station, you look at Deborah Smith, who translated Han Kang's The Vegetarian and who now runs Tilted Access Press. They first of all, are really enthusiastic about books. They're kind of self-effacing in a way that writers can't be, because writers have to say, buy my book, whereas translators can say, this is an amazing book, and they kind of don't give themselves even the credit, you know what I mean? And they have a very interesting take, because they're extremely close readers of a book, and they've given so much thought. Similar to the point you're making, not just to what's the, you know, French word for this? They've also given thought to what's the thought behind the word.
Yeah, what's the subtext? What, are they, what's the sort of the what is nebulous? What is it that's almost unsaid that is being said? Yeah, they've got to find that.
So exactly. So they're not just translating; they're kind of they're conveying in the new language what was in the original. And they may have to change the words or abandon words to convey the sense rather than strict, you know, Google Translate. Can have ham sandwich. Thanks, mister.
Oh, along with your novel of cliches, we could do a novel of Google Translate.
I should translate my own work into English. Into bad English. Yeah. Translate it from good English into bad English.
That's
to make it gooder.
Good. Make it much better. Proper like. Speak proper, as my grandmother used to say. Speak proper. Be like a lady. Ain't a word. Don't forget that. Ain't a word. It's like, what are you saying?
The Irish version of ain't is amant. We say amant. No, I amant.
In Scottish, they sort of say that too, don't they?
Yeah.
Amna. Yeah. I amna. That's a bad. I'm sorry.
When I was in London, Tony Paul, Finn Webb, the editor, the book isn't set anywhere, and I didn't want it inadvertently set in Ireland. Not that I was trying to deny it, but we had to go through quite a lot of the editing, was finding those things that I thought were normal phrases, but which are actually idiomatic to Ireland. You know, so we had quite some interesting conversations. Like Rasher stayed in, because she said, well, we'd say rasher of bacon. I said, well, we wouldn't say bacon, because bacon in Ireland is boiled ham, you know, it's going to the size and thickness of the palm of your hand.
I'd say rashers.
Yeah, but you know, we actually got to the stage where we were exchanging links to like Bacon Today magazine, and here's, you know, well, you know, in Canada they call it bacon, you know. So we went through all this kind of thing, not in an argument, but kind of a fun way. We're trying to outdo each other for like, well, in the end rasher stayed, but with other words like missalette, which is, you know, the leaflet, the wedding leaflet. You know, is that Irish or not? Well, they use it in the Philippines, they use it in the US and Ireland, the only few places apparently that says missalette. And so the editor went off and talked to her, you know, her practicing Christian friends, and said, no, apparently missalette's okay. It's, you know, it's not just, and it's not that we were trying to, you know, completely, you know, savagely extract it from Ireland. It was just, I didn't want it in, because I'm an Irish writer, I didn't want people inadvertently setting it there. Yeah. Again, it's just avoiding the labelling.
Yeah, you're just letting it, letting it sort of float free from sort of.
Just a closed world, create a new closed world. Yeah. Like, almost like a, you know, in theatre where you kind of, you only have a few sort of scenes or backgrounds, you don't necessarily have to say, oh, look, there's the Statue of Liberty in the background, are you?
Yeah, you haven't got to have these big signifiers going, we're here, by the way. Yeah. It's funny how language works, though, isn't it? We, for years, our middle daughter thought the correct way, we would say to her, oh, I'm doing it all by my own self. All by my own self. And it was just a family thing. We've got lots of these sillies. And bless her heart, you know, she started work, she's grown up now, and she didn't reach, so she said to someone at work, I'm going to do it all by my own self. What is up with you? And she came back to us and said, I did not know. How could you? And we also always say, lettuce. Do you want some lettuce in your salad? And she thought it was a kind of lettuce. Poor
what is it?
I sound evil. Lettuce. Just said with this kind of an Italian. Lettuce. Aren't we awful, sending these poor children out to the world thinking there's a way of speaking, and everyone else is like, what is wrong with you?
My mother told me loads of lies about it. We're a family of eight children, so she told us that Black Forest Gatto had splinters in it, you know, so that the four younger kids couldn't have any, so they could just split it between the older kids. So we've loads of things to that.
Oh my word, I love it. That is brilliant. You should build a novel around the splinters in Black Forest Gatto.
I had one other line as well, which
is so imaginative. She's great.
Yeah, she told loads of you know, blatant lies like that. Some of which I can't use anymore. They're kind of, I'll tell you off mic. You know, that you told us that. If I'm using now, would be you know, I'll get me in trouble. But it's just one of those. I think it's only when you start writing you realise how much you've collected through childhood. You know, the phrases and little memories that are kind of stuck somewhere. That you thought were universal, but they're not. They're just, you know, unique.
That's the great joy, isn't it? Being able to dig through those things and find.
Yeah, and they're all there. Like, you don't have to. They're actually pretty accessible. You know, if you can just pause for a minute, think about them. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And I can't wait to the next book.
Thanks very much.
Ronan Hisham for chatting with me. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Joe Dunbar for the music, and speak to you soon. Happy writing, happy creating. Take care of yourselves. Lots of love.